Welcome to Voices from the Front Lines. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web on KPFK. This is your co-host, Manuel Criollo, for Voices from the Front Lines. Voices is a national movement building show, a show that tries to bring organizers and the people who are making history, the people who are thought leaders of the oppressed, to bring together, to dialogue, to build, you know, a bigger movement toward changing society, ending racism, ending empire. And so today's show, we're dedicating it to from Los Angeles to Ferguson and Ferguson to Los Angeles, and the growing movement about the constant attacks on our community through police brutality and police murders from, you know, Mike Brown on August 9th out in Ferguson. And of course, you know, 2 days later here in Los Angeles, in South Los Angeles, Ezelle Ford was also assassinated by LAPD. It's an important dialogue, an important movement that's happened over the last 2 weeks in Ferguson and across the country. For the first time, there's real conversations about the need for true civilian accountability to police brutality and murder. There's real conversations about the militarization of our police. So today's show will be some very important key leaders in the movement. Here in Los Angeles, we'll be first joined by two organizers from the Youth Justice Coalition, Kim McGill and Tanisha Denard, two important figures here in LA who have been working with the friends and family of Ezelle Ford to bring more accountability and to bring, you know, answers to Ezelle's death. But we also will be joined by Brandy Brown, who is a very good friend of Ezelle, who knew him and who knew him in the neighborhood. And we'll hear from their perspective about the work that's being done here in Los Angeles. And then from Ferguson, we're joined by two important organizers. One is Hiram Rivera, who's the executive director of the Philadelphia Student Union, and also Jonathan Stilf, who is the national coordinator of the Alliance for Educational Justice. They have been in Ferguson for the last couple of days, and they will be joining us here today, talking to us about the important work that's being done in Ferguson, the organizing that's happening, sort of post a lot of the actions, and of course, yesterday's funeral for Mike Brown, and hear from them and their perspective. So, as I said earlier, at this top of the hour, we're being joined by Kim McGill and Tanisha Denard. They're both organizers with the Youth Justice Coalition. And also Brandy Brown, who was a friend of Ezelle Ford, and the Youth Justice Coalition and many groups here in Los Angeles, but Youth Justice Coalition in particular, have been doing a lot of work with the families and friends and neighbors of Ezelle Ford. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So why don't we start with Brandy? Why don't you, because often, you know, in most of the stories about when somebody's assassinated by and killed by police, Often we only hear sort of one side stories about the person, but why don't you help us, for the folks here on KPFK, hear from you about who was Ezelle, how'd you know him, kind of personality, you know, who was he?
Okay, Ezelle was a friend of mine. He was a good person. I knew him by standing in the same neighborhood. He was the type of person, if you met him, he'll speak to you, you know. He was just, like, a good person. Like, I feel like he didn't deserve to get killed by the police because he wasn't that type of person. Like, he did not pose a threat to no one.
And, Brandy, how long did you know him? And while, obviously, the story has been sort of related that Ezelle had been very well known in the neighborhood, and in fact probably very well known also among a lot of the police officers that patrolled the neighborhood, get us to know, how did Ezelle sort of relate to the world? Was he out a lot? Was he in the neighborhood a lot?
I've been knowing Ezelle for, I'd say, about 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he, like, when you used to see him, you used to see him, like, walking to the store, like, going to get some chips or a soda or something like that. Like, you can say he was, well, yeah, he was out a lot, like, going back and forth to the stores. That's when I seen him.
Tanisha, why don't you help us understand sort of what's happened since this very tragic occurrence, and what has the work that the Youth Justice Coalition been doing up to this point?
Well, so far we've been attending a lot of community marches that have been going on. We also had a forum that we had where the chief was there to answer some of the questions, which a lot of them didn't get answered. So there's a lot of community and family still left with a lot of unanswered questions. And since then, we've just really been trying to get the state attorney general to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate so that we can actually have some type of charges or something like that for the officers that shoot people, because at the end of the day, they still get paid, and people still are able to come to work and stuff like that, and we don't even get to hear like how many write-ups they've had and different things like that. So right now we're at the point of just getting more answers and kind of just giving them a role and trying to figure out why they use weapons first, mm-hmm. and just really trying to figure out what's going on, trying to stop the violence in our community.
But you know, as the story broke off in Ferguson, because Mike Brown was killed on August 9th, and as Ezell Ford's was killed on August 11th, and I know almost later in that week we had just found out about Omar Obrego, who also was killed not that far away from the area that Ezell was, and over this weekend there was just two other exposés. One about the big cash-out sort of settlement that was done to the family of a former military man who was shot by LAPD. And I was just reading earlier this morning about the case of another person who was killed in custody, as he had been raising issues about him being having asthma and having problems breathing, and that, you know, there was no quick sort of response to what was happening to him, and he died in custody. Kim, the conversation about, I know that the work that you've done, not only here in Los Angeles, but also in New York, about the issue about police accountability, I know for you, for a person who's been an important warrior in the front lines around these struggles, do you feel like there's some important movements that are happening because of the high visibility and the ability to connect in certain ways that maybe 15 years ago, 10 years ago, maybe it wasn't as possible, in contrast to today? And then what do you think are also some of the challenges that we have in trying to hold police accountable to these murders?
Well, I do think there's a growing movement across the country, and the ability for people to connect through social media is important. It's much harder for people to remain invisible with the shootings that are happening. There's a lot more use of cell phones and other technology to get pictures out, to get video out. There's even been live streaming from rallies, protests, police actions that has never happened before. And hearing from people who live in communities that aren't impacted by police violence, for them to see things live streaming is a very different reality than to get it something edited through their local television news, which oftentimes has a very pro-police bias toward how they report things. So I think those are important developments. I also think that many groups across the country are getting wiser about how we collect data, share data, talk about the issue. There was a really important report that Malcolm X Grassroots mm-hmm. Movement put out a couple years ago about the number of black men in particular that are being killed by police. It was pretty astounding when they looked at the data across the nation, as opposed to just looking at data, which I think we've tended to do in our local areas. Given all of that, I think there's still huge challenges to do police accountability work and to do all work to decriminalize communities and to address America's and our local areas' addictions to policing and prisons. And I think some of those challenges in current times is that the police are getting a lot more masterful at manipulating and using the media. So it used to be that the police violence was much more blatant, and even police use of racial terms and racialized tactics was much more blatant. They've gotten really strong at being able to spin their own incidents and their own data. So I think, for example, if you look at L.A. and now New York, Chief Bratton, who was the police chief here and is now police commissioner in New York, is really talented at using the media and putting the ownership on a single officer as opposed to on real change that the department needs to engage in, or looking at departmental changes as the minor things that need to happen as opposed to the really significant things that will address police violence or a reduction in policing. So I think that's something that we need to be cautious about and be more critical of. The second thing is that I think police are more and more taking over roles that were traditionally community roles. So at a time when police violence is increasing, and also at a time when arrests for crimes all over the nation are decreasing, you would think that we'd be seeing less money going toward policing and less money going toward prisons. But we're seeing an increase in those budgets across the country, and definitely here in LA. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that police are reimagining themselves. As they're seeing an age of kind of our traditional sense of mass incarceration, they're seeing themselves as the new mental health experts, the new intervention workers in our communities, new designs on school police and school security. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's another thing that we have to be very concerned about and push back on and make sure that that money doesn't increase or get transferred to them, but that it stays in our communities for mental health workers, for outreach workers, for community intervention workers. And then lastly, I think, you know, we still struggle in the United States to have a real movement identity. and a coordinated movement. Most of the protests around police shootings occur without clear demands or without demands of any kind, and we still see a lot of people that call for the jailing of quote-unquote killer cops. Where we do want to have individual officers held accountable, we think it's a lot more important to hold departments accountable and look for the real policy change that would stop these shootings, as opposed to scapegoating individual officers that leads to very little change over time.
We're being joined. You're listening to KPFK and here on Voices from the Front Lines, and we're joined by Tanisha Denard and Kim McGill from the Youth Justice Coalition, and also Brandy Brown, who is a friend of Ezell Ford. Ezell Ford, who was killed by LAPD on August 11th in South Central Los Angeles. And, you know, we're talking about a conversation about what's happening here in Los Angeles and obviously the relevance of the struggle that's happening in Ferguson after the killing of Mike Brown. You know, Kim, I think we've spent a lot of times talking about these pieces that you've raised. On one hand, you know, yes, LAPD and much of the sort of modern community policing sort of rhetoric has shifted in a way that, you know, maybe 20, 30 years ago, that conversation was so blatant about, you know, sort of the police often saw themselves as sort of the occupying force in the neighborhood and in many ways are able to shift that conversation. Second, I completely agree with you that while I think in many ways, right, we're seeing important sort of, you know, breakthroughs, things like the movement to raise stop and frisk, some of the movement that's being done in the school to prison pipeline to sort of decriminalize student behavior. In some ways, the police is trying to negotiate a situation where we're restricting them on the edges, but at the core, their budgets are going up. The level of real, true accountability that's happening often doesn't happen. And, you know, the third piece, which you're raising, which I know in talking to the people in Ferguson, the issue around demands that go beyond just the actual incident. When you look at sort of me and Julian, we're just driving here to the show today, and we were talking about the issue around how now in Ferguson is what's coming out is the way that many of the people were being criminalized way beyond Mike Brown had ever sort of happened, and now it's sort of coming out front and center. Let's talk about LAPD around the demand around some type of accountability to a broader policy of holding the police accountable for these killings. We've seen that, you know, here in LA, while there is a review board, a civilian review board, it often has no real power. It has no real independent power to prosecute or to even be able to, in many ways, go beyond sort of the limitations that the police Bill of Rights limits people. Where are you seeing any sort of openings where we can try to sort of exert a real conversation about how do we really bring sort of oversight to the police?
Well, I think Tanisha mentioned this also, but we're at the point where we feel we have to go beyond the county. We can't expect our local district attorneys to prosecute officers when they depend on those same exact officers in those same departments to make all their other cases locally. So we're calling on State Attorney General Kamala Harris, and I think it's something that all states should consider, to appoint a special prosecutor. It is her role to supervise and monitor prosecutors across the state, but to appoint an independent prosecutor that can be independent from those county entities to investigate police shootings and prosecute where necessary. We're also calling on the Department of Justice at the federal level to open another civil rights investigation against LA, but not just LAPD, but look across our county. LA, not to say that this violence isn't happening across the country, and it is, but LA far surpasses even other large cities like New York or Chicago in terms of the number of people killed by the police. And despite all the rhetoric about changes in the LAPD, those shootings have actually gone up in the last 7 years. Between 2000 and 2014, we've had 590 people killed by the police in LA County, and the numbers from 2007 to 2014 is 310. And we're going to be releasing a report this week that looks at all those killings and also statistics by race, by where it happened in the county, by gender, by age. But I know listeners won't be surprised that despite the fact that African Americans in LA County are about 9% of the population, they're 28% of the people killed by the police in our county, and Latinos, 51% of the people killed by the police. We also want to look at the fact that, like Ezell Ford, many people are killed who have mental health issues. We're very concerned in Ezell's shooting that the mental health team, it seems like, was never called, and if they were called, was definitely not waited for before the shooting happened. So those are all things we want to start to document and question.
Yeah, I think that's awesome that you are able to put a report that really tries to lay out. I know another thing that people could do is the LA Times has this sort of, you know, the homicide sort of report. And obviously you can actually break down in that sort of database that LA Times has, which probably doesn't even have all of them, but is recording, you know, sort of police linked, you know, sort of homicides in it. And I think that the ability for us to be able to, like you were saying, Kim, earlier on, the report by Malcolm X, grassroots movement, you know, it started up every 36 hours and, you know, now it's moved to every 28 hours. The report lays out the sort of extrajudicial sort of killings of particularly the black community. But obviously we know that sort of in many communities, because just like, you know, it's interesting, there's a lot of conversations about Ferguson and Los Angeles. But, you know, there was a big movement earlier this year in Albuquerque, New Mexico, around a set of killings in Albuquerque, in Salinas, you know, right before the summer. There had been a sort of a rash of police killings in Salinas. And in many ways, a lot of people are responding, both from a courageous outrage of sort of moving beyond sort of the tactics of just protest, but obviously some really intense confrontations with the state itself, and obviously the reaction has been very strong. Tanisha, why don't we talk about what's been the organizing that you talked about? You know, there's been a set of actions that, you know, you guys have been taking part of. What are you guys thinking of as some of your next moves? I'm hearing that there's a call for putting Kamala Harris to play a bigger role in trying to bring in some accountability. Want to talk a little bit about some of the work that the Youth Justice Coalition is doing in the neighborhoods and sort of how are you navigating probably many of the coalitions that are happening as we speak?
Right. So like I said, there's a lot of coalitions that are still doing rallies every day and stuff like that. I know in particular there's a rally going on at like around 6 o'clock every day on 65th and Broadway. And as for us right now, we're putting together a report following up with the forum that we just had, and we're also trying to meet with the Inspector General that we do have to get some of these questions answered that weren't answered at the forum. And we're also about to release the report and make sure we get that out through an email blast and also to the community where Ezell was shot at.
Brandy, you know, as a friend of Ezell's, what's some of your hopes? What kind of support do you think people should be giving out in the public? Again, this is called Voices from the Front Line, so we're hoping that people actually take action, not just sort of want to discuss these points. But what are you hoping people can sort of help in the day-to-day for your neighborhood and to bring justice for Ezell?
I just feel like everyone that's out here is saying, like, everyone is saying, like, they're tired of this police brutality or whatever. I feel like people have to get up and take a stand. Like, you can keep saying you're tired and you're tired and you're tired, but if you don't get up and you don't put no effort into it, like, what's the point of saying you're tired? I feel like more people need to get out and it needs to be more rallies in so the police can see, like, that the community is not playing no more, like, we want justice. Like, this cannot keep happening. So I feel like more people have to come out and put more effort into it for us to get some kind of justice.
You're listening to Voices from the Front Lines. This is Manuel Criollo, your co-host for Voices from the Front Lines, here at the 4 o'clock hour in KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web, kpfk.org. We're being joined by Kim McGill and Tanisha Denard of the Youth Justice Coalition, and Brandy Brown, who's was a good friend of Ezell Ford. We're trying to make these connections between Ferguson and Los Angeles, Los Angeles to Ferguson, really Los Angeles to New York, Los Angeles to Salinas, you know, Los Angeles to Albuquerque. We obviously, as Kim said it earlier, LA and really is one of the sort of battlegrounds of regions where police murder has occurred. And in many ways, we know that there's been important movements to try to curb criminalization, to curb the type of state violence that we see in our local jails with the work that's being done by YJC and others around trying to bring a civilian review board at the LA County jails and the structure that's played out there. Kim, you know, I know that you've done a lot of work in this arena. Where do you think that are some opportunities for us to be able to make some important new breakthroughs in this time period?
I think there's a few trends that are happening. I think we tend to think of policing in maybe 1990s type style, but the police departments, because of having greater access to resources, particularly financial resources and technology, are far surpassing where we even are imagining them going. So I think part of what we need to do is start organizing around the real changes that are happening in police departments, and also how we're exporting that type of policing not only throughout our own nation but to the rest of the world. One of those areas is in terms of increased militarization. You know, L.A. was the first to have battering rams, the first to have SWAT, the first to have helicopters. Now that's become regular across the nation. We saw it in Ferguson and also becoming regular in the rest of the world. So I think that's something to get ahead of and talk about how that constant militarization of the police and the use of military technology against civilian populations has huge impacts on people's psychology, their ability to feel safe, and their issues around post-traumatic stress. Secondly, we're seeing a huge ramping up of police surveillance, whether it's the use of drones that was, you know, in our case, was first used over Compton without permission by the community and is now being used in other parts of the country, or the use of really sophisticated cameras using GPS tracking and monitoring, where in the public housing developments in Watts, you can, from the local police station that's like 2 or 3 miles away, read the ingredients of a gum wrapper on the ground. You can follow, you can reposition your cameras to follow people. You can shoot images from the police department to the individual squad cars. Two, review boards that you already mentioned really don't have teeth. So this kind of rush by police departments to say, oh, we'll have a civilian review board or we'll have community oversight, but then there's no real authority to investigate police shootings or other police misconduct or to have any say in the discipline of those officers. And in the case of some review boards, like what we have in L.A., they have oversight over policy but don't use their oversight nearly enough. So what we're asking for here locally is that, and across the nation too, I'm sure this is the case, that there needs to be a youth representative on those review boards, that families who have buried their loved ones due to police violence need to be represented on those boards, and that formerly incarcerated people or convicted people need to be on those review boards, and that those boards need to have real independent authority to not just advise police departments but to oversee police departments. We think that civil rights leaders who were very vocal on these issues maybe a decade or two ago and then won certain agreements with police departments have now become almost champions or cheerleaders of police departments. And I know that's really hurt us here in L.A. Mm-hmm. So for all civil rights leaders and human rights organizations in the country to recognize that if we have police violence, then almost all other human rights is not being upheld. That's the most degrading thing, certainly, that we can do to people in terms of state violence is to kill people. And then finally, to really push police departments that they don't re-victimize people that are victims of police shootings and police violence. We see over and over again, and you can see this in, for example, you mentioned the LA Times homicide blog, where almost always who media goes to question about these shootings is police departments themselves. They rarely talk to people in the community. They rarely even talk to family members. And family members, oftentimes, it definitely happened in Yazelle Ford's case, are not even allowed to see their family members at the coroner's office or in the hospital, are not notified police when their family members have been shot, or at least not in an immediate fashion. They usually hear from the news or from the community long before they do the police. And then what they hear on the news is that their loved one was allegedly on parole or on probation or an allegedly a gang member or allegedly armed. And oftentimes police have to correct those versions in later weeks, but by then the damage, the re-victimization has already happened. So that's the other thing we're calling for, is that all police departments make a statement as to the fact that it's under investigation, just as they protect their own officers in these shootings and never say anything about the officers, not even releasing the names, but simply say that it's under investigation. So we want the same respect for the people who are victims of those shootings. I think there's a lot that we can do locally, too. We're going to be putting out a petition for everyone in California and everyone across the country who wants to support. Also, that'll go to our state attorney general and to Attorney General Holder to intervene in Los Angeles. But if we could start to also link up across the nation, because this is a national problem, and think more creatively about how we could work toward a more lasting solutions to these issues.
We've been joined by Kim McGill and Tanisha Denard of the Youth Justice Coalition, and also Brandy Brown, friend of Yazelle Ford. The Youth Justice Coalition has been doing a lot of important work in the Yazelle Ford, but obviously has been an important sort of leader around issues around police murder and the criminalization of our communities here in Los Angeles County and across. And I think one of the most astonishing pieces that talking to you, Kim, and Tanisha and Brandy, is also that in some ways, you know, I think for most people in the world or most people here in Los Angeles, you know, if you don't live in certain neighborhoods, if you don't live in a radius of 10 or 15 blocks, you don't know what in many ways is playing out. You don't know the heightened level of policing that constantly happens. You don't really know, if you're also not a young person, don't know the level of sort of from the sun up to the dawn, that the type of harassment, the type of sort of feeling like you're always under the watch. Imagine if you live in Los Angeles, you wake up, you walk out your street, out of your door, the first people who are greeting you on the street is LAPD. You get on the train, you know, you're being checked for your fares, harassed inside the train system. You get off the train, you go to school, who's the first person you see is the school police. You get out of school, you know, you got to go visit your probation officer because of something that caught you up earlier. And then you go back home and you try to sort of finagle the streets as ways as you can. And then again, once it gets sweated, it's a level of policing and dehumanization to really break people's spirit. And in many ways, I think most people just can't even fathom that that's what's happening on a daily level, let alone that now the question is not, are you going to get beat up? When I was young, that's what you worried about. Was the police going to stop you? Were you going to make a sort of funny move and get beat up? But now the question is a life and death issue. And I think that there really is a real need to really build a movement. And I really want to thank the Youth Justice Coalition. And I really want to thank you, Brandy. Really are encouraging other people out in the neighborhood, people here in Los Angeles, to really care and hopefully act, because ultimately that's what we need to do. And with that, you know, I really want to thank you all for being on the show, and we'll be right back with Hiram Rivera and Jonathan Stilf, who are two organizers from Philly and Washington, D.C., who've been over the weekend in Ferguson and who were there yesterday at the burial of Mike Brown in Ferguson and in St. Louis. So stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. You're listening to Manuel Criollo. I'm your co-host today for Voices from the Front Lines, Voices National Movement Building Show that's trying to bring organizers together, the important thinkers of our times, the important actors of our time, to talk about strategy and tactics and movement building. And as we just, you know, had a wonderful sort of on top of the hour, we had Kim McGill and Tanisha Denard of the Youth Justice Coalition talking about Azelle Ford and the movement to really bring justice to Azelle and many of the people who have been killed by law enforcement here in LA County. And because we're a national movement building show here, we also felt that it was important to bring the voices of people who are doing important work throughout the country around these issues and about criminalization, about the issue around accountability of police. And we have on air Hiram Rivera, who is the executive director of the Philadelphia Student Union, and also Jonathan Stilf, who is the national coordinator of the Alliance for Educational Justice, two important organizers who have been in Ferguson over the weekend trying to support in the ways that they can sort of post the shooting of Mike Brown and the important community response that happened over that time period over the last 2 weeks. And they were there yesterday at the funeral of Mike Brown. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Why don't we start with Jonathan? Jonathan, why don't you tell us, you know, I know you guys have been there probably a couple of days out in Missouri. What sort of initiative for y'all going out there, and what have been some of the things that you've been sort of working on?
Absolutely. We definitely answered a call from one of the local organizations, the Organization for Black Struggle, who called for black youth organizers to come down and to help support the organizing and the resistance that young people in Ferguson have been waging. And to help them think about what kind of work and campaign they wanted to build moving forward out of this moment, and really how to use this moment to build a movement to not only address, you know, the relationship between young people and police, but all the overall conditions of young people and black people in St. Louis.
So you guys have been there probably 4 or 5 days, I believe. And what has been some of the work that you guys have been doing? Sort of, you got there probably as the National Guard probably was leaving, or I think maybe you guys were in that same time period when that played out. What have been some of the sort of sentiments that you've been seeing? What's been some of the work that you're seeing? What's been some of the dynamics that are playing out?
Well, some of our work here, we definitely have touched on and trying to do a real quick transference of skills, really understanding that struggle is a school, but we've been doing workshops with young people and adults around, again, how to organize with young people, how to help them build power. We've seen a lot of the work on the ground right now has been really trying to, again, mobilize folk, deal with the trauma and the shock of the death of Mike Brown, and what that's meant for the community. So a lot of healing work has been happening, as well as trying to really deal with the influx of folk who come to Ferguson to stand in solidarity. So it's really helping to build infrastructure and really rolling up, and a lot of it's been rolling up, I see, is getting to work, and also doing nightly patrols of the force and avenue, just in case there is another attack by the police. There hasn't been since we've been here, but we've been training people how to handle the tear gas attacks, and then being out on the street kind of helping to provide some level of protection if that does happen.
Idam, I know you work in Philly, and you've done a lot of important work around trying to raise the issue of the sort of everyday criminalization of our people, especially in the school setting. What's been your sort of experience? How does Ferguson compare to places in Philly that you've seen in your own work?
I think there's a lot of similarities. I think that there are a lot of frustrated young people when we've gone out to the Canfield apartments, is where Mike Brown was shot at, and spoken to the young people. A lot of stuff that they're talking about is they complain about not having jobs. They complain about their schools not having enough programs. They complain about harassment from the police, harassment from folks inside of school buildings. They complain about housing, right, and the state and the condition in which the neighborhoods currently are. So there's a lot of similarities I hear from the young people here in Ferguson, as well as the young people in Philadelphia. And they're just fed up, and they're just really tired. In terms of the criminalization over here, I think St. Louis is about 90 different municipalities within, like, just literally blocks of each other. And what you have now, what we heard from some folks, is that there are about 24,000 bench warrants that are out, but only about 21,000 citizens. Right? So there are more warrants out than there are people in the city of Ferguson. So the level of criminalization here is, like, through the roof. And folks are just fed up and just tired of it. And like I said, the young people articulate some of the same frustrations that the young people in Philadelphia do around their education opportunities, their housing opportunities, their lack of employment opportunities, and just overall no clear vision for a successful future at all.
We're talking to Idam Rivera, who's with the Philadelphia Student Union, and also Jonathan Stilf, who is the National Coordinator of the Alliance for Educational Justice. They have been in Ferguson on the ground over the last couple of days, both trying to figure out ways that they can support the movement that sort of has emerged, and trying to obviously sort of take some lessons of what's playing out both in Ferguson and sort of the broader issue around accountability of police murders and sort of the criminalization of daily life. Why don't you talk today about how the funeral, sort of what it feel like, what it looked like, so people can get a good sense of what that felt.
I think the funeral had a bunch of different moods, right? And it's I think when you have situations like this that get put up on a national stage, there's sort of a spectacle element that ends up arising out of this. So I think the mood was generally somber. A lot of folks who were sad. Were upset. A lot of folks who were out there showing, solidarity. There were a lot of folks out there who were trying to make a buck and, using the moment for their own personal gain. I think that, and mind you, where the funeral was is about, I would say, 20 minutes away from where the murder happened and where that community actually resides. So I'm not sure if the folks from that community made it all the way down to where the funeral was. So what you saw was a lot of support. You got a lot of folks like the White House representatives, Al Sharpton, and those types of individuals showing up. But there was a lot of people. I think it was about 97 degrees outside. Folks stood in the heat. They didn't leave until it was time to march over to the cemetery. And a lot of folks who are still upset about what happened to Mike, who are still calling for justice, and who are still committed to continuing the struggle.
Jonathan?
Yeah, I think Hiram hit it on the head in terms of the mood. It was definitely a lot of people throwing their hands up. But overall, the funeral was peaceful. And I think, again, it was, just a groundswell of support. I think one of the things I would, one of the textures I would add was, part of the Black Bikers of St. Louis, came about 200 deep and, led the procession out. And I think that was, kind of really powerful statement in terms of how cross-cutting the issue was, and at one point it heard one of the elder kind of bike club members yelling at the press, stop referring to us as a gang. We're a motorcycle club. And I think that was an example, kind of the continued prevailing criminalization of our people and the media's role in that, in creating that spectacle and also creating the suspension and tension that exists in our communities.
You know,
one thing I like, can I add one thing?
Go ahead.
Before, the day before, there was also a peace fest, and what you find in the community is a lot of confusion, right? And what we have found is that when we're out in the streets, I would say 2 out of every 4 people are from out of town, right? And there's a lot of confusion. Everyone's coming with their own ideas, their own thoughts of what should happen or how people should be feeling. And some of the local folks, I think, feel a little confused. They're still trying to process the 2 weeks of battling they did in the streets. They're still trying to process what happened to Mike. They're trying to process, right, what is going to happen afterwards, right? The same thing they keep saying, once the news cameras leave, once all of you go home, it's going to be us and those cops again, right? And those cops are pissed off. Right, and just gonna, we're going to be right back here again with them without anybody else. And what you see is interesting things have popped up, right? And the day before the funeral was this huge, like, a party. It was like, they called it a peace fest, and this interesting thing of having the parents of other slain young men. Trayvon's parents were here. Oscar Grant's uncle was here. Other folks who have lost children to state violence, right, and police violence are here, and it's almost like a celebrity factor calling on peace, right, and doing a job of really putting the responsibility on the citizens themselves and the locals themselves to kind of like suppress their anger, suppress their rage, right, to kind of swallow their pain and here, right, have a Coke and a smile while you're at it, and we're going to play this music and throw you a little festival, and they try to create these party atmospheres, right? The church is out strong on Florissant Street where the battle was having, and they just have these roving, like, gospel bands, right? And it's just this constant, like, party atmosphere with the intentions of keeping these folks and keeping the young people specifically occupied and not angry, right? And the message is not so much about, coming from those folks, right, not so much about holding the police accountable as much as it is young people in Ferguson holding themselves accountable, right, and kind of swallowing that rage and that anger and that pain and doing something else with it. And for me, that's been a pretty interesting thing, just how many of these, like, peace parties and this party vibe that they try to create with the purpose of suppressing young people's anger. At the same time, you don't really find those young people who were in the cancel departments, who were the ones out there fighting with the police, at those events either, right? They've just kind of, like, gone off somewhere. They don't want to deal with the clergy, who is working hand-in-hand with the police department, right? The clergy sit in the McDonald's there, and they coordinate with the police department, and they don't want to deal with those folks at all. And it's just this interesting thing where the community is really trying to figure out how to process all this, how to make sense of this, how to move forward while all this other stuff, you know, the spectacle of people on a almost a safari-like atmosphere, right, where folks are just driving in from out of town, from all over the place, taking pictures in front of the murder site, taking pictures in front of the project, taking pictures in front of the McDonald's or the, you know, the gas station that burned down. And it, so it's a lot even for us who are not from here to take in and process. And how do you make sense of that?
You're listening to Voices from the Front Lines on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 90.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming on the web at kpfk.org. We're joined by Iram Rivera and Jonathan Stilf. Iram is the Executive Director of Philadelphia Student Union. Jonathan Stilf is the National Coordinator of the Alliance for Educational Justice. You know, today's show we've dedicated from Ferguson to Los Angeles, and really Los Angeles to the world, about the increased militarization of our communities, the police murders that have been occurring almost what feels like almost every day. You're reading and hearing, and both importantly, that also the communities in many ways are also responding. You know, obviously earlier on when we had Kim McGill, and we had a really good conversation about some of the work that's being done here in Los Angeles. And obviously, in some ways, Los Angeles is sort of, unfortunately, one of the centers of real police murder that's happening in it. And in many ways, while LAPD has done an important job at really being able to do the press work very well, where much of what's been perceived as, hey, we no longer have the LAPD or the Wild Wild West that we had in the 80s and 90s. In many ways, true accountability has not happened. The increase of their budget, the increase of their power and influence in the city is very, very much felt, not only, you know, obviously in the streets where a lot of our young people are being criminalized on the daily level. We're seeing it even in the type of power and influence that they have in making police policy and even public policy for the whole entire city. And one of the things that Kim and I were raising was this really important sort of report by Malcolm X movement around every 28 hours and some of the key demands that have been raised around that report. One has been about creating a national database of all police murders. You know, I think I just saw a story yesterday about how finally one newspaper sort of tried to bring them all together, and they showed that in 2012 there was about 400 police murders that happened, was able to be recorded. Where do you think, as you're saying, what seems very overwhelming for anybody who, let's say this popped off in any of our in our cities, how would you respond on one level, the actual real power and violence of the state itself, right? And obviously, in many ways, most of us are not well equipped to figuring out, well, what do you do if basically the police calls a nighttime curfew, brings out sort of these hearing shocked cannons to knock out your hearing and your balance that can tear gas a whole neighborhood? That's one issue. And then secondly, if you're having a real struggle and battle, in essence, in the streets about your own outrage that people are feeling, then, you know, what is the sort of long-term sort of vision of what to do? Because as Kim said earlier, and I totally agree with her, often our demands about bringing justice to that killer cop rather than, as you said, Idam, how the hell do you have more warrants for people than actual people in the population, is speaking about a greater sort of type of oppression and repression that's happening to communities of color, but particularly in the black community that's playing out in most of our neighborhoods. How do we make sense of all that? And what do you think, you'll still be there for a couple more days, what do you take back from all of this?
I take back that, you know, Chokwe Lumumba once said that where there is no heart, there is no movement. And when we talk to young people in Ferguson and it's clear that they had a lot of heart and very little strategy, and they, you know, they prevailed and drew us here really on a lot of heart, and I think that we should really hold that up. I think then for us thinking about that, I think that's why MXGM, we wrote Let Resistance Be Your Motto, which is the handbook for organizing new African communities, and it is based around kind of three principles or three kind of conditions, right? How do you respond to police and state violence, and through kind of trying to prevent it through cop watch, and then also what needs to happen in terms of building black self-defense networks. The second part of the curriculum really deals with what we call intercommunal violence, right, or misnomer, the so-called black-on-black mm-hmm. violence, and how do you build communities that are safe for our, you know, for ourselves, for our children. And then I think the third piece for us is a question of, around self-determination. And again, part of the curriculum also deals with people's assemblies, right? And how do you build out communities that are self-governing, self-determining, that can determine its relationship to the police, to the state, in a real way. Again, as Chokwe was famous for saying, kind of letting the people decide. And what does that mean? What are the mechanisms that need to go in place in building that? So I think that is part of that long-term work that needs to happen, that we can see that needs to be built out in Ferguson. And I think even then extending that beyond, then connecting that to the work that we did with the Jackson Plan, right, and just kind of what is our overall vision of kind of rebuilding our communities in this particular moment and advancing our struggle and our cause. And and so I think that's part of it. And I think, you know, again, one of the things that we also learn here is that struggle is a school, and that, you know, these young people in Ferguson have learned a tremendous lesson that they should be sharing with the world in terms of what it means to really stand up and be heard and stand up, you know, in defense of yourselves and your community. And the piece around the database, and, you know, we wrote the report every 28 hours starting in 2012. I think it's interesting, or we should note that there were 409 killings from our data. Almost 300 of those were black people, right? And so we just, again, have to be very clear about the relationship between ourselves and the police, that it's one of murder and mass incarceration, and that as a community we have to deal with it. And it cuts, you know, it cuts across all classes. I've heard some folk, you know, say it's every 20 hours black men. No, it was black people. It includes black men, black women, and black children. We, and we're clear about that.
We've been joined by Iram Rivera and Jonathan Stell. Jonathan is the National Coordinator of the Alliance for Educational Justice, and Iram is the Executive Director of Philadelphia Student Union. They've been on the ground in Ferguson trying to, you know, sort of find ways that they can support the work out in Ferguson and make sense of this broader sort of connections about war that's really happening on Black America and the war that's really happening to Black people and communities of color, that the way that police is sort of playing out. You know, this show really today was an opener for us because many of us will be going down to Ferguson as Voices from the Front Lines to record, as both Jonathan and Iram talked about, that in some ways there's already important sort of lessons of what the grassroots people did in Ferguson, but more importantly, what is the sort of kind of support that people on the ground need, obviously from Los Angeles, but from the country, to be able to support them and to be able to do their work, for them to be able to sort of guide their work, what kind of resources they need to sort of help forward. So we hope that, you know, people could stay in touch with Voices from the Front Lines, where we will be airing next week's show with a lot of the recordings that we're as we go down there. Again, I really want to thank today's show, where we had our great guests like Kim McGill and Tanisha Denard with the Youth Justice Coalition, and we were also joined by SL Ford's friend Brandy Brown, who made an important plea for all of us to really take seriously our ability to just sort of act and the necessity for us to act. And I really want to thank also Iram and Jonathan for giving us sort of pretty much a sort of step by step of what's playing out in Ferguson and sort of how do we take these sort of lessons out to the world. So I really want to thank you, the listener, here on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and on the web at kpfk.org. This is your co-host for today, Manuel Criollo. We really want to thank everybody here at KPFK, our engineer, Nadia Richardson, and also our producers for Voices from the Front Lines, Crystal McMillan and Julian Lamb, for putting together this great show. So I hope that people can join us next week as we'll bring back important interviews from the ground, from Ferguson, here on Voices from the Front Lines. And stay tuned for the next show.